One thing about me is that I'm mortal, like I'm an organism, which is weird on its own. Like I'm a collection of literal atoms that decided to hang out together for a while and which will eventually be unable to hang out together any longer. And then I will, this is the weirdest part, cease to be. And there's nothing that can be done about that because, like, planets and stars also cease to be. It's a real conundrum, and I'm not going to find my way through it in this advertisement. But we can make life less terrible for those who survive us, and that's why there's life insurance. I have life insurance because the people who are counting on me will be supported after my atoms can no longer hold it together, and Policy Genius is here to make life insurance easier. Policy Genius isn't an insurance company, it's a marketplace where buying insurance is straightforward and affordable. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams, so check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I like to think of it, Dear DeBokey and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers, and sometimes a brother and a friend, answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Today we are joined by DeBokey Chakravarti, who is our editorial assistant, who's always helping with interesting science facts. DeBokey, I recently got mad at my son because he was inhaling helium out of a helium balloon.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't like him talking to me in that tone of voice. Thanks. Appreciate that.
How long do I have to pretend that I'm laughing for?
That was good. That was perfect. So DeBokey helps with a number of things, but mostly is a sort of science consultant on Dear Hank and John, because we get a lot of science questions, and there was a time when I would wing them, which went well 90% of the time, but that 10% was a problem. And now I don't have to wing them. And what we do is, DeBokey and I, before every episode of Dear Hank and John, we have a little phone call where we talk about science questions and Mars, and I learn some things. And make sure that I don't get anything too wrong. So DeBokey's always on this podcast, kind of. What we've decided
I'm the silent voice in the back being like, no!
Don't say that! And since John is on a little break, I was like, why don't we bring DeBokey into not a silent voice? And we can just answer science questions for a day.
Yeah, so now I can listen to this afterwards and say no to myself. Like, I can have the retroactive self-criticism instead.
You should not have. No, you should not have. But look, that's part of the fun. No one expects it to be 100% right. It's dubious advice and almost definitely correct science information.
Those are my specialties, so.
Where are you and what are you up to these days?
So physically, I am in Massachusetts, in the western part, between a bunch of schools, and professionally, emotionally, all over the place. I do a lot of different things for Complexly, I guess. I work on this, on Tangents, on Journey to the Microcosmos. We've still got Crash Course Organic Chemistry going up, so I've been hosting that
as
well.
Yeah.
So a lot of different things, yeah.
And then you also do freelance editorial work for a number of different places.
Correct.
And you started, and your degree is in?
My background's in biomedical engineering, so I did that through undergrad. I also double majored in English, but that was kind of just for fun because I wanted to be forced to read books while I was in college. Uh-huh. And then after did my PhD in biomedical engineering and spent a long time trying to teach T-cells how to do things.
I actually tried to teach T-cells how to do things in my undergrad.
Yeah, they don't listen. They just don't want to do it.
They do all kinds of stuff. It's wild. I did not realize how stupid the immune system is until I started to work on it. But it is extremely complicated, and they're just like, I'm just gonna be a different person. You know, like some days you kind of wish you could wake up and be a different person.
Yeah.
It's like, can I be Reese Witherspoon for a day? A T cell can do that.
Yeah.
It just decide.
And the thing is, it's so stupid, but it's also so brilliant. Like,
oh, of course.
That's why, like, it's so hard to understand. Like, you can spend your entire life trying to map out the immune system and trying to understand what it's doing. I mean, people have been trying to spend their entire lives doing that. And you get to a point, I think, where you just have to accept the large amount of things you're just never going to get about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank God for the immune system, though mine does attack me. Mm. But look, it's complicated. Yeah. And I get it. It's confusing in there. There's a lot of different cells, and you have to decide which ones are bad, which ones are good. And it can get confusing sometimes. Yeah. And then you just make me miserable for periods of time.
Yep.
I'm mostly better now, but only thanks to modern, miraculous, and tremendously expensive medicines.
Yeah. Yeah, what little we have learned about the immune system has already made, like, a lot of progress. So that's the great thing.
That is the great thing. So we got a lot of science questions, but we've also got, like, we're not able to answer all of the science questions. And there's often been times when we're like, what do we do with all of this solid gold material? And we haven't really figured out a thing to do. But here's one thing we can do. We can have all science question episode of Dear Hank and John. And I assume you've listened to the podcast.
I have.
That's great news.
Wait, this is a podcast? I've just been waking up on Mondays and answering science questions for fun.
And I think that we're just answering some science questions. I liked this one. It was from Ben, who asks, Dear Hank and DeBokey, could we bring back Neanderthals today? Like, if we really wanted to for some reason, considering we have sequenced their genome and all. Pumpkins and penguins, Ben. Have we sequenced their genome and all?
I think so. I guess I kind of accepted the premise of the question. Now I guess I gotta...
I'm throwing a wrench in.
Yeah.
I think that we've got pieces. I don't know that we've got all of it.
Genome.gov says that in 2010, researchers had produced the first whole genome sequence of the 3 billion letters in the Neanderthal genome.
That sounds like a whole genome.
Yeah.
Jeez, I guess they're not. It's wild. Like, you forget how recent it was.
Yes.
That we had other members of our genus.
Yes. And I just can't imagine it. I just can't imagine,
oh,
like,
God.
Being like, oh, there is this other sort of different kind of version of me just, like, around.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, yes. And, you know, there would have had to have, I don't know, maybe there wouldn't have had to have, but it feels as if there would have to be some kind of large geographic separation. But if there was that large geographic separation, it seems entirely possible that a civilization could evolve and then discover that, oh my gosh, we actually aren't alone here. Though,
true.
I don't trust us to not end that situation pretty rapidly.
Yes, I'm curious, like, who would have been the most trustworthy of all of these early humans. But maybe the fact that we're here is the sign that we were the least trustworthy of all. I've been watching a lot of Survivor lately, so I'm feeling very nihilistic about like groups of people on islands.
I tell you what, the Neanderthals would not have made it through this. That guy, they would have gone home in the first week.
Yes.
just far too nice.
Yeah.
So we do have a full genome, and just stick it in an egg, right?
Yeah, maybe. The thing is, like, it's so hard to get DNA into cells to begin with. And again, just coming from that background of, like, trying to get T cells, which, like, it is good that your T cells will not just, like, accept any DNA willy-nilly.
Yes.
Like, that is technically good, unless you're trying to graduate. But it is technically good that it is difficult to put DNA into cells. But I think particular, like, there are some human cell lines that people have created that are easier to engineer. Mm-hmm. Whether or not we can then turn them into, like, a stem cell that's going to become a little, like, Neanderthal baby, like, that's a lot more complicated. And then whether or not you would even be able to have that baby develop, like, inside, I assume, a surgate, I think.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
gets to be You're really gonna, complicated.
Yeah, we can't have babies outside of people or animals yet. That's a long way off still.
Yeah.
Though certainly the date at which you can have a baby out of a parent is getting closer and closer. So what's interesting to me there is like, my thought is just stick some DNA in the egg. But it turns out cells have a lot of procedures for not having new DNA show up. Mm-hmm. That is often happens in problem situations,
yeah,
like viruses and also just mistakes. And so that cell might be like, oh, something's wrong. I'm just going to off myself.
Yep.
Which they do a lot.
Yeah.
But we have been able to put some DNA into cells before, right? Like, is that how cloning works?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for sure. Like you're saying, like with viruses, like that is actually a way that we get DNA into cells all the time. It's, again, not simple and straightforward because even making these kinds of viruses can be like pretty difficult because viruses are also not necessarily super excited about having a lot of strange DNA put into them. So there's like limitations on how much DNA you can put into it, what kind of DNA you can put into it, and then getting the virus into like the cell and getting it to like put all that DNA. Like there's a lot of issues. Like I've had this conversation so much like with friends where we're just like, what if like we know what the sequence is. Like I know what the sequence is on my computer of what I want to make with the DNA. Why can I not just get it into the cell? I feel like I should literally be able to print a cell out that has all this stuff. And apparently biology is pretty complicated.
We're not there yet.
Yeah, I
have confidence that that will be a much simpler proposition for students of the future. But for a DeBokeh of the past, I'm sure that you are banging your head against a lot of walls.
Yeah, it's going to be the like my most like children of the future who like learn how to clone in like third grade. Back in my day.
So there's the question of can we, which currently I don't think we can, but like I think probably. If like, you know, society continues to progress, that we will be able to. And then we will be faced with the question of, should we? Which, of course, we should not, right?
I don't think so.
You can't. Yeah. It'd be like bringing about, like, I can see bringing back a woolly mammoth. Even that is hard, though, because elephants have strong culture, but not like a Neanderthal culture. Like, bringing back a culturalist Neanderthal seems like, it's almost like that's not what it is. That wouldn't actually allow us to learn very much about them because that, you know, in addition to the fact that you've created a person theoretically just for study and for kind of to see if we could is a big problem. But then second, like that's not really what we want to know so much. You know, it's not really about their physiology. It's about who they were and how they acted. And we can't know that because we will never recreate that environment.
For sure. Like, we're not bringing them back into the world of Neanderthals. We're bringing them back into a completely different world. And that's where I feel like a lot of resurrection talk to me, I can never tell if it's like my own failure of imagination where I'm like, I don't find myself super curious about what it would be like to resurrect Neanderthals or woolly mammoths. I just find myself kind of like hitting a wall of like, well, like, okay, I guess we bring the woolly mammoth back, but then like,
Then you go to Jurassic Park, like, and then it's just a zoo experience. Like, it's not like the ecosystem is lacking for woolly mammoths.
Yeah.
I think. I could be wrong. Like, it may be that the ecosystem still kind of exists in a way that, like, it would be more dynamic if it had that sort of giant grass-eating machine. But
yeah.
I feel like the caribou are doing the job, you know?
Yeah, and ecosystems are just so complicated that you just throw something in there I mean, it'll do something. Like, something will happen if we put woolly mammoths back in the world. But it will probably more than just, like, a unidirectional kind of, like, oh, yeah, now this is going to do that. And now the ecosystem's different. It's, like, going to be, like, a whole series of cascading things.
Yeah,
so I guess maybe that is, like, a curious thing. I just am not personally ever, like, oh, cool, I want to know what's going to happen.
It is... You know, I am interested in de-extinction when it comes to, you know, the potential future where we have a world that can sustain that organism that went extinct. But if there's a reason it went extinct and we haven't fixed that problem yet, then there's no reason to de-extinct it. Because, then it will just be a lot of maintenance for a symbolic thing, really, rather than... something about the earth, something about the ecosystem. And I think we think of extinction symbolically a lot, where it's like, if we lose that last one, then we've lost it forever. And like, that is, you know, obviously that is very true. But the reality is that the loss is that there isn't a world left where that organism can survive. Like, and we haven't changed that yet. Yeah. Anyway, that's a bit of a bummer. I want to ask a different question. This one is from Kristen, who asks, "Dear Hank and DeBokey, would I get sick if I were to eat the Mona Lisa? Nothing funny rhymes with Kristen." Kristen, what about like, listen to Kristen, Kristen? That would be good. Listen to glistening Kristen. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Can Kristen eat the Mona Lisa?
I mean, now that we've tried to rhyme her name, sure, why not? But no, okay. I don't recommend it.
Would she get sick?
Yeah, yeah. Da Vinci was not painting the Mona Lisa with safety
like edible,
in mind.
Edible inks, yeah.
I mean, to begin with, like, I guess the stuff it's painted on is like a thin plank.
Yeah, so, wood. It's painted on wood.
Yeah, so yeah. So you're eating really old wood. I don't...
Which is fine. Like, I feel like I could... A lot of people... there was recently a... this was on... I think... I don't know. It was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, maybe. Or the other one. That there was a bakery that couldn't sell cookies or couldn't name their cookies because they had too much sawdust in them. And I was like, oh. So then I guess you can eat wood.
But what if that sawdust was essential? What if you just called it a sawdust cookie?
Yeah. Look, I don't know how the laws in whatever country that I heard about that thing that I vaguely remember work. But I can tell you that if I ground up the plank that a Mona Lisa was on and mixed it into enough cookie dough, I could definitely eat it.
That definitely sounds like something that's going to be like served at a future like billionaires, evil villain kind of like situation.
Everyone eat a little of the Mona Lisa. Well, look, here's what you could do. You just shave a little bit off the back. You don't have to eat the whole Mona Lisa.
Yeah. You can also just tell people that the Mona Lisa is in what you're eating. No one's going to like look at the Mona Lisa and be like, is something from it missing? So if you were to like have a menu and be like, this is a Mona Lisa cookie with shavings of Mona Lisa on it, no one's going to like fact check you. Except for the fact that they're not going to die because they're not eating lead and they're not eating like bone dust.
Oh, okay. So there's more to it than just
yes.
bone dust.
I guess this is in some of the pigments. This was not a time of a very safe, well, I don't know if now are times of necessarily safe pigments, but Da Vinci was definitely painting with some stuff that could make you sick. There was a primer that had lead in it. There was bone dust. Okay. There was mercury sulfide. Like, there's stuff in the pigments that will also just probably not be good to eat.
Interesting. Okay, this makes sense. Then you really do want to just scrape the back off. Look, I don't know. Like, I'm not saying this is good. I'm not saying I would do it. I'm not saying that I would like it, that if I was at a party where this was happening, I wouldn't be infuriated, but I could absolutely see someone buying a Picasso and like scraping a bit of it off and putting it in a cookie and like that actually being a thing. Like, I'm not making it up. Like, I could see a debauchery party in Cannes where they're all drinking, you know, gallons of rosé and it's like the cookies have a Picasso in them. I think that the Mona Lisa is safe.
Oh, you think it's safe from being turned into a cookie?
Yes, I don't think it's safe to eat.
Yeah, I think
I disagree with you, DeBokey. I've heard that lead is bad for you, but that's just the experts.
I mean, has anyone tried?
And I'm going to do my own research.
I'm going to march into the Louvre right now and test this out.
But DeBokey, you said that one of the concerns was bone dust, and I have to make the case that I could definitely eat bone dust.
Well, if you're going to make that case, so far, everything that I have found about what makes bone dust bad for you is about like breathing it in when you are cutting up bones. Mm. So,
okay.
Maybe.
Look, bones are fine. Animals eat bones all the time.
True.
I think we're fine. I think I can eat bone dust. I don't think that I can eat lead, though.
Yeah, I think maybe it's the lead.
So it would make you sick, but it probably wouldn't kill you, is I feel like where we're at.
Yes.
But not like a little bit sick for a little while.
I mean, how
while.
Much of it are you eating?
Like sick
I
forever.
Think if you eat the whole thing, you are going to be doing so great.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. I could hear that.
It's all in the dosage.
Everything's a poison at a certain dose, including the Mona Lisa. This next question comes from Joey, who asks, "Dear Hank and Topoki, why have no other animals evolved to intelligence similar to our own? I feel as though there are some who have had just as much, if not more, time." Well, for clarity, all life on Earth has had the same amount of time.
Yeah. Like,
could it still happen? I think kangaroos should be next, Joey. Cute.
I like the idea that it also could just be like, there are animals that have been alive as long as I have and have just like not bothered to learn things in that time.
get together.
Go to school.
This was one of my first like learning moments that I remember. I said to my teacher, if trees have been around so long, this is like third grade, why haven't they learned how to walk? which is like basically the same vibe as this question. Like, why didn't a tree learn how to walk? And the answer is twofold. One is that trees don't need to walk because they're doing just fine. The other is that like the pathway to get to walking involves a lot of other changes that trees have not made. They have not had to make. And that was in a different branch of the tree, you know? So like the muscles are very different from how plants move. And so and also like the requirement of, I mean, now, but Debokie, now I'm questioning, I'm questioning whether or not a plant could walk. Because they can move.
Yes.
And some of them can move quite quickly.
There's a whole thing about like whether or not trees are like in forests are migrating, right? But that's more about like the collective forest. That's not like tree.
Sure.
That's not like we're not like at
an individual tree.
Yeah.
An individual tree can move, but only if the ground also moves.
Yeah. Could a plant walk? Okay, so I don't know if like an individual tree can walk, but I think what they've done instead is like construct a really elaborate system of being able to disperse. So like that is like what is valuable to them and their like method of survival.
Right. And instead of like going to find someone to mate with, instead they attract pollinators to move their genetic information around.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that's like,
they solve the problem in a different way.
Yeah, because it's like, we could look at it as, well, why haven't trees learned how to walk? But it's also a question of like, well, why haven't we learned how to survive without going anywhere? And everybody in our society is all just rooted to the ground. So who's really the intelligent one here?
That also has advantages.
Yep.
I could just sit here and eat sunlight.
Yep.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
Can you do that, little Hank Green?
Yeah. I think about this every time with Microcosmos, because anytime I learn about a new organism for Microcosmos, I'm like, wow, you've like really crafted a great lifestyle for yourself. Like
you figured it out.
I think I've done so much in my life. And then I'm just looking at this tiny little microbe that can just like spring itself from a single place and just grab food. And it doesn't like have the ability to like see or hear anything. It just has all these other mechanisms. Like, wow, I don't know how to do anything.
I got to tell you, Rotifer, you seem happier than me.
Yeah.
Like, if all being equal, but intelligence is great. And I do think about this sometimes. And obviously, intelligence has evolved independently on Earth several times. You know, the best example being octopus. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just like, these animals are very smart. And they definitely didn't get smart from... And like the root of their smart isn't really connected to the root of our smart.
Yeah.
You know, except in as much as like it's a nervous system that has like a, you know, common connection to animals. But like its smart is very different and acts very different. And I have heard people say a couple of times if like octopuses lived longer, then they would be just as smart as us. I don't think that this is how it works.
Yeah.
But I do understand the temptation of that thought, that because they are so short-lived, like they tend to only live for like a year or three.
Yeah. Yeah. Does their intelligence go through like aging?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'd love to talk to an octopus expert about it. Like how does an octopus learn how to be smart? How are they taught?
Yeah.
But I have no idea. you know, I think that there is a piece of it that is, do you need it?
Mm-hmm.
But the, so like, the, does the tree need to move?
Yeah.
But the other piece of it is, do you have the sort of requisite complexity to do it? Which, like, that is both a no for the tree in both cases, yeah, with walking. Like, a tree doesn't need to walk, but also doesn't have the like, sort of anything like the physiological background to evolve that trait.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, brains take up a lot of space. They take a lot of resources, like, both through, yeah, development and after. So that's, like, mm-hmm, that's a lot. Like, you're going to need to want, like, you're going to need to get a lot out of the brain, I think, to make it all worth, right, it.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that we get out of the brain is good. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of the first, I don't know. The thing that I try to remember about people is that, like, our smart is a side effect of our communication.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the thing that really makes us special is that we can very efficiently communicate a lot of information from person to person. Even before we had, like, the internet or telephones or media, I mean, I guess we had media even back then. We had stories. We had, yeah, the systems of sharing information are really good with people. And that is the advantage that brought is what brought intelligence. So as we got better at that, there were more benefits. And so there was this sort of this evolutionary feedback loop where the better you got at sharing information, the better you got at surviving. And the thing that made you better at it was intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you just basically need that to happen in kangaroos, Joey.
Yeah, yeah. Need to get all these animals to start telling each other stories. Sitting around a campfire.
You need some reason for a kangaroo. You need some reason that a kangaroo needs to tell a story in order to survive.
Yes.
All kangaroos. And if you are a bad kangaroo storyteller, somebody comes along and the kangaroo god just is like, no, you are no more. You are a non-living kangaroo,
yep,
now.
I mean, we say this, we just don't know what their stories are. I mean, they could be talking that's a true lot of smack about us, and we just don't know.
Absolutely, they are. Have you seen them? Oh, God. I used to play a lot of those Maxis Sim games. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
So back in the day, in the 80s and 90s, there was like Sim City and Sim Earth and, yeah, Sim Life and Sim Ant, and it was just like, just games that didn't have a goal. Like, you created your own goal, mm-hmm, and they didn't have an end.
Yeah.
You couldn't, like, beat them.
Yeah.
And so you made a city, but there was one called Sim Earth. And in Sim Earth, you could, like, naturally, if you sort of, like, had the best environment and a lot of diversity and a lot of life for a long enough time, intelligence would evolve. Mm-hmm. And then you could have cities and et cetera.
Yeah.
But also, you could sort of give something like an intelligence bonus by dropping a monolith on them, reference to 2001. And now this wouldn't work on everything. You couldn't like drop a monolith on like a bacteria and get a super intelligent bacteria.
Yeah.
But like you could sort of decide, I want my planet to be sort of full of intelligent cephalopods, which was very good.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, so like, what did that look like in the game? Like they would start like talking to each other or like they'd build a little like cephalopod
culture?
No, they
were just like, they're literally just like an icon on the screen. And like they, I think that they got like a thing. So instead of just being a octopus, it was an octopus with like a staff or something. and like the unmoving pixel icon of them would then spread and then they'd have cities.
Huh.
I've always felt like it'd be very difficult to have civilization underwater. And I think that this is... But I do not know why.
Why you think that, or why?
Like, it seems like
difficult.
If it would be possible, I don't know why I think both. Mm-hmm. Like those are the same thing. But it seems like if it was possible, it would have happened there first.
Yeah.
Because life has been there for so much longer.
For sure. But also, like we know nothing about the ocean. I would not.
So what you're saying is there's a chance.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. I have not ruled out the possibility of mermaids is what I am saying.
Okay.
I mean, whales exist. Whales and dolphins exist. And
yeah,
whatever
uh-huh,
it is they're doing is... Mm-hmm. I was
more complicated than we
yeah,
think.
Yeah,
yeah.
Whether or not they would have like built palaces is like... a different kind of story, or like whether or not they would be like waving staffs around, that's a different story. Mm. But
right And they do use tools, like dolphins use tools, which is and teach and learn from each other.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, if I like try to conceive of like an underwater like civilization, it always looks like the Atlantis movie, The Little Mermaid, Aquaman. Like, I cannot imagine anything that doesn't look like that. So it always seems absurd. Like, I just, it always like is inherently fantastical.
Yeah. I always try and think of how chemistry would, like, how would you build a chemistry lab underwater? That would be very hard because there's water everywhere.
Yeah.
You'd have to create a big air pocket and then go into it so that you could mix things together.
I bet there are underwater chemists who are like, how do they do chemistry up there? There's air everywhere.
All right. And also, like, it's not like chemistry was necessary for civilization and for like humans to evolve.
Yeah.
Like, we had you know, intelligent human beings a long time before we. And I could totally imagine agriculture underwater.
Yes.
And there's no reason that, like, if a dolphin figured, like, the problem is that dolphins don't eat grass.
Yeah.
But, like, maybe they could figure out a way to farm crabs or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm in. They're farming lobsters and they're eating them and we don't know about it. They're just doing it.
The way that we can't, like, conceive of, like, human beings and Neanderthals living in the same society, I think whales and dolphins have figured that out. Is what I've decided now. And so the underwater society.
As of 15 seconds ago.
I've solved it. I've now understood the entirety of the underwater empire that's going on. And they're all working together because some of them want to eat, like, animals. Some of them don't. So, like, this is a collaboration.
The underwater empire.
And there's a crown in there. Oh, and it's okay. No, there's no crown. This is starting to feel more realistic if I, like, put it in those terms.
There's no crown.
No. We're going to remove the fantasy elements. We're going to remove the Aquaman, the Little Mermaid. And if we describe it strictly in terms of whales and dolphins, then I think the marine biologists have to agree with me.
Okay.
This is why our meetings are only 30 minutes. Because if they were any longer, we would get to the whale and dolphin empire part of the show.
This next question, Boki, it comes from Ray, who asks, "Dear Hank and Deboki, what is the skin of your teeth? I'm quite certain that there is no skin on my teeth. Is there?" I am quite certain, but not 100%. Is this one of those stupid English things? I'm confused, Ray. It's not a stupid English thing. I think it's a great phrase.
Yeah. I mean, I hear skin of the teeth and I think of all the things that, like, don't come off your teeth when you brush them.
Oh, so I got through it by the bacterial film.
Yeah.
On my teeth.
Which I assume is not actually what it means, but that's just what I imagine it as.
Well, I think this is how I feel. It's an excellent identification of a very weird thing, which is that we have a living body part that is not covered in epithelial cells and only one.
Mm-hmm.
And epithelial cells being the, so like, you know, like they are the skin cells, but also they're in our digestive system and they're in our mouths and at other places. And, but on teeth, they are living, but they are not, but they are exposed. They are like, so
yeah.
Either the skin of your teeth is your enamel and then underneath that is the living part. So that would be like one, that would be like a metaphorical skin. So you have like your enamel that is covering the living part, just like your skin is a kind of a dead part of you that's covering the living part. But I think that it's saying like, this is a living part of you that you got, it was so barely there that you got by through by like an imaginary invisible thing.
Yeah.
So like the only part of your body that you can't skin, you skinned it.
Yeah, I don't think I ever really had like realized what an existential crisis around skin and teeth there are. But I think that makes a lot of sense. Like the idea of it being like representative of like a basically imaginary barrier. Like I was thinking like, oh, it's like something super thin, but like to the point of being basically like just metaphorical, like because it just doesn't even exist. I like that. Apparently, like its actual origin, or at least where people have found it, is okay. From the Old Testament.
Well, if it's in the Old Testament,
yeah,
it's old.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess when Satan is trying to like tempt or break Job, I'm not super all completely well up on my like Old Testament stories, but Job like actually says, "My bone cleavers to my skin and to my flesh, and I escaped with the skin of my teeth." But I don't think that it's clear what skin actually referred to there. So, but
it's just, yeah. I mean, we're metaphorical. We're poets.
Yeah.
We've always been that way.
I feel like, because I think when I was in high school, because it was a private high school, we actually ended up reading the Bible, and it was sort of like with the goal of like learning some of that kind of metaphorical language. Mm-hmm. And I remember the camel through a needle or something.
Sure,
it's like, that's like one of those ones where it's like one of those things that sounds impossible and it could be in one interpretation, but then it's also like maybe more about like a hair. And this feels like that kind of thing maybe then, where it could be imagined or it could be super thin.
Right. Like So what you're saying is that potentially this is just a mistranslation and we've just stuck with it because it sounded good.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Deboki, I've heard that you are a Bible scholar.
Yes, that is actually what I'm here for. Yeah, I'm glad that we started out with I'm here to answer science questions and we've now come to Deboki, the Bible scholar.
I need you to do poetry and metaphor and Bible.
Yeah.
Because John's not here and I don't know how to do those things.
Well, okay.
That's the John job.
Yeah. It is interesting. Like, it is weird to think about, like, what we think about when we're saying, like, because these kinds of phrases, like, you think about it all the time. Like, you say them or you hear them. And I've never thought twice about the skin of my teeth. I've been like, yeah, that makes sense to me in my head. But actually, now I'm going to have a crisis about it every time I hear it. Because I'm like, going to be like, well, I'm going to ask whoever uses it. I'm going to be like, do you mean that, like, metaphorically this way or metaphorically that other way? And it's very important to me.
Is the enamel the skin or is it an invisible imaginary skin or is it the bacterial film?
Yes.
Which is it?
Yeah.
I need you to explain which skin is on your teeth.
I'm going to ask my dentist the next time I go. Tell me, dentist.
You must think about this, which reminds me, Deboki, that this podcast is brought to you by Tooth Skin. Tooth Skin. It's we're not sure.
The only certainty is that we do not know. This podcast is also brought to you by Mona Lisa Cookies, just barely edible.
It's the dose that makes the poison. This podcast is also brought to you by T-cells. They do not do what you want them to do, which is probably for the best if you have a body, but not if you have research to do.
This podcast is also brought to you by octopuses with stabs. They stab things with their staffs.
They've got stabby octopuses and ultra smart kangaroos who are talking about you behind your back.
Yes.
Deboki, we've also got a Project for Awesome message for this edition of Dear Deboki and Hank. It's from Alana Maddie, who says, hello, Hank and John. sorry, Alana.
Yeah, I'm very sorry.
He'll listen, I promise. From the wonderful music community over on Twitch, we raised money for the Project for Awesome together this year, and it's been wonderful meeting fellow nerdfighters on the platform. I didn't know about this music community on Twitch. This is cool. Thank you for all you do as a longtime listener, first-time caller. It's been wonderful following you both on your journeys and finally getting to participate in this small way is an honor. DFTBA. That's lovely. Thank you, Alana. This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. The inside of your toilet is gross, and that's why you shouldn't let anyone in your household drink out of it, including your dogs, please. Let them drink out of the bowl. The toilet is where the poop goes. There is an easy way to clean your toilet, though. Blue Land's sustainable toilet cleaner tablet. Just drop it in, watch it fizz, brush it up, and then flush. It's super easy, and the great thing about Blue Land is they are figuring out how to do all this stuff without any plastic at all. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and for the planet, and with the same powerful clean that you're used to. It uses no single-use plastics in any component, from bottles, tablets, to wrappers, and even to shipping. The tablet packaging, by the way, is fully compostable. Blue Land products are effective and affordable. The toilet tablets are proven to work on a range of toilet stains, including rust, mineral deposits, limescale, and hard water. And look, when it comes to me, I don't really care that much about bacteria in the toilet, because again, That's where the poop goes. That's where it's supposed to be dirty in there. But it is nice to have something to help you with those mineral deposits, which we have in abundance in Montana. You can get even more savings by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription. Their subscriptions are customizable and convenient, so you never run out of your most used products. We have been a Blue Land household for like 3 years now. It's super convenient, super good. Like it a lot. The products look nice. They're easy to use. And again, they do not require single-use plastics or shipping a bunch of water around, because it's like the stuff that's going to be in the water, you can just dissolve it in water yourself instead of having the companies ship water from place to place. Why are we doing this? Never do I think to myself, oh, this is less effective than other cleaning products. It's just not. It's effective, it's easy, and it's affordable. Blue Land has a special offer right now for our listeners. You can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You don't want to miss out, everybody. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. That's blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off. This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Thrive Market. T-H-R-I-V-E is how that's spelled. You may or may not be like me. Here's a thing I know about myself. If I put it in my house, I'm going to eat it fast, in no time flat. And so I like to shop in a way that makes sure that the kinds of foods that are in my home are the kinds of food that should be in my body. You know what helps out with that is having a go-to grocery and household essentials thing that I can, that just like pops up on my phone and it's like, hey, do you want to order your monthly thing? And I'm like, yeah. And then I pick the things that I want in my house and I don't pick the things that I don't want in my house. And the moments when I actually have self-control, which is not when I'm standing in front of the pantry. Thrive Market's super great, whether you're looking for organic kid snacks, low sugar alternatives, or gluten-free pantry essentials, which I absolutely am. And those, the pretzel bites with the peanut butter inside of them, to make my wife so happy. She's like, I can finally have peanut butter pretzels again after developing a gluten allergy. It's fantastic. And as a Thrive Market member, you save money on every single grocery order. On average, you can save over 30% each time. They even have a little deals page that changes like every day, and you can go and see it and see like, maybe I want to try out some new fun thing. They got all kinds of brands on their website. They got Amy's, Banza, Burt's Bees. They got Mike's Hot Honey, Oatly Olipop, Poppy, Salt. When you join Thrive Market, you are also helping a family in need with their one-for-one membership matching program. You join, they give. Join in on the savings with Thrive Market today and get 30% off your first order, plus a free $60 gift. Go to thrivemarket.com/dearhank for 30% off your first order, plus a $60 gift. That's Thrive Market, T-H-R-I-V-E market.com/dearhank. And they have told me to say it one final time, even though at this point it seems like a lot. ThriveMarket.com/DearHank.
Okay, our next question comes from Ben in Ohio, who asks, in Andy Weir's book Project Hail Mary, the main character mentions that turning on a flashlight in space would move the person holding it. Is this true? If a flashlight is brighter, is the force greater?
Ooh. I mean, you're going to have to guess that if Andy Weir's busting out a fact like that in a book, that he is going to catch so much flack if he got it wrong. There's a very low chance that he's got it wrong.
Yeah.
When you write books for science nerds, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
That I interviewed him when that book was coming out, and I was like, and actually I read it beforehand, and I don't want to brag, but I fixed something.
Oh, nice. That's
yeah. I was like,
exciting.
You forgot a vector. Here's how I would rewrite it if I were you. And he was like, "Wow, thank you. That would have been really bad."
Got to keep those vectors straight.
Yeah, there's.
I would like put that in a bio. I mean, I know it would be rude, but I would probably if I had done that, I would have been like, "Yeah, I corrected Andy Weir."
Yeah, I do. Man, I read a lot of books, and where I'm like, they should have called me. But when it comes to physics and photons, do not call me, because I have no idea. But yes, it would. But why and how? And yes, it would be more if it was brighter. But like, explain to me how a thing that has no mass has momentum. Go. Like, I don't know.
Oh, I had decided to accept that as the premise for the answer. I was like, cool. Physicists say that photons have momentum. I'm going to accept that. And from what little I understood when I was looking this up, because I was very confused. confurious. I was both confused and curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually does feel very apt to describe how I felt researching this question. There are, like, our equations for describing momentum that do have mass in them, but there are other ones that, like, then come into play that explain why light has momentum as well. And so that's basically what's happening here. But at least from what I understand, if you wanted to try to get anywhere with a flashlight in space, like, you're going to get there very, very slowly. Like, it's especially because if you're attached to the flashlight, you have a ton of mass. So I think that's going to slow things down a lot.
So the flashlight on its own would travel significantly faster.
Yes.
But that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to get back to your spaceship, and you can't. You only have one option. It's to get back to your spaceship or you die, and you got a flashlight. And the answer to this riddle is you die.
Yes, you sure do. Apparently, this is like a very popular question on exams. So we might be like helping some people like cheat a little bit. But apparently it's like even faster. This is like a trick question where it's even faster if you just like throw the flashlight. Like that's what's going to get you faster. Mm-hmm. But because you've thrown the flashlight, if you get lost, like if you made a mistake, then like you're kind of screwed because you're just on whatever trajectory.
You can only throw a flashlight one time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this, like, you could test this in a lake. Like, if you're on a canoe, you can throw a rock, and it actually, like, the harder you throw the rock, the more your canoe moves in the opposite direction because you've pushed against the rock and its inertia. And that is how rockets work, is they throw lots of rocks out their butts and it pushes them up.
That's why named it a rocket. They just put together rock and butt and took out the B.
That's correct. Put it on the Wikipedia page, everyone.
And cite this podcast. Deboki Chakrabarty said this.
Don't vandalize Wikipedia.
Yeah. Especially in my name. Yeah. There's not a lot of search results for my name, and I don't want this to be one of them.
Now that you've done this, now that you've involved our names, Deboki, I have to get rid of the fun and eliminate it. No, you can't. No, don't vandalize Wikipedia. Anyway, so you could throw the flashlight, or you could toss the photons out, but it's just a tiny force. But you did talk here about how it does matter, and there are things that we measure and that we have to account for this photon stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So there are these other weird effects that come up in terms of radiation and light and how that affects the movement of things in space. There are actually, like, asteroids that have their trajectory altered because of the way that, like, sunlight will hit them. And if they're, like, irregularly shaped and, like, they're kind of, like, rotating in a certain way, it's, like, the way that the light hits them will heat up one side of the asteroid, and then as it's like rotating, it'll cool down, and that actually like pushes the asteroid. Like that cooling like creates a force.
So it's not the photons or just the photons.
Yeah, it's, I think, also it's this heating, really more radiation. Process. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Oh.
Yeah. Sorry, okay. I put this here at first because that was the first thing it'd come up, and then I didn't delete it just because I thought it was cool because I'd never heard about this. It's called the Yarkovsky effect. And it's like a thing that actually makes it harder for scientists to know if asteroids are going to collide with us. So that part's less cool. But the effect is cool.
So it's not like the asteroid isn't on a perfect path as would be defined by gravity, because they're like this tiny force is acting on them when they radiate heat away.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're basically giant flashlights, but in the infrared spectrum.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah. Space is just a bunch of flashlights floating around.
Yeah. That's how we see a lot. I mean, when you're looking at the stars, like most of the mass that is, you know, normal mass is stars.
Mm-hmm.
And they are big flashlights.
Yeah.
And we can see them. There they are.
Yeah.
I can't actually right now. It's daytime. And I'm inside, and it's cloudy. All the different reasons.
Okay, daylight savings is done, so the stars will be up very soon.
Yeah. Oh, man. You're in Boston, or in Massachusetts, so you what do you get? Like, what's your earliest sunset? Like, 4:30?
I think we're now, like, something ridiculous like that. Yeah. What's our sunset? 4:27 p.m., so not even 4:30. It's the worst, yeah.
This next question, Deboki, it comes from Bronwyn, who asks, Dear Hank and Deboki, last night, in Vancouver, we had a very intense lightning storm, and I was thinking about how much power it generates. I was wondering if people have ever tried to use lightning as a sustainable power resource, like solar power. Just build really tall metal poles and then capture it somehow. I don't brawn lose, I brawn win. I liked that. I didn't think I was going to like it as much as I ended up liking it.
Is it the saying it out loud makes it more fun?
Yeah, totally. So I've heard that there are people who have wanted to do this. And obviously, like, this is a tremendous amount of energy. There's a lot of energy that comes from, you know, water moving around in the sky and creating all of this wind, and then that creates this electrical differential that then can bridge a gap of many hundreds of feet when you're just or even like more than that. Like, these lightning bolts can be huge.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of energy, and I do want energy, and I'd love for it to be created by storms instead of by fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And I remember writing about this in the old days in EcoGeek in like the early or mid 2000s, and like that there were people who had tried to do this, but there are problems.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems really hard.
Yeah.
Like, this feels like Neanderthal DNA all over again, but like not even without having to get all biological. Like,
yeah.
There's lightning has a lot of energy, but like it's like over a super short amount of time. So you got to be like super fast about it.
Yep.
You got to be able to store it all.
Uh-huh. Yeah. If it turns, unless there was a lightning bolt that just hit all of the time and never stopped, that would be great. But unfortunately, it's like one at a time.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just like Ben Franklin it and just like have the energy always coming down.
Yeah. Well, now that you say it like that, I feel like what we should do is figure out how to generate like a very localized lightning storm that is like in one spot, and then just put the plant there, and it's just always getting the lightning.
Well, there is,
I don't see any downsides yet.
There is a place on Earth that almost always has lightning. It's a lake in South America or like an inlet in South America. And,
interesting.
And because of the geography of the area, it's pretty much a constant lightning storm.
Well, then that's perfect.
So that would be the place to do it.
Yeah. Then we just got to figure out how to get the lightning. That's, I think, the next challenge. But okay, cool.
Lightning
now I've been
storm.
Convinced. I think we can do this.
We just have to go. We have to go to, it's in Venezuela. Venezuela? Excuse me. That's embarrassing. It's in Venezuela. It's called Lake Maracaibo. And the shape of it, so they have lightning storms 140 to 160 nights per year.
Oh, wow.
9 hours per day, 16 to 40 times per minute. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
But it's not every day.
Yeah.
But that is way more than I'm comfortable with.
That is a lot. It sure is.
16 to 40 times per minute. That's like almost once a second.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I think I'll stay here.
Yeah.
We get like three lightning storms a year.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine even having to try to like construct a plant in the middle of all this? You're like, well, this is the one day of no lightning.
Can we turn the lightning on for just a month so we can build this thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it comes in really hot. So it's hard to capture.
Yeah.
And then you have to store it, because you can't just like send it onto the grid. That would probably create some problems.
And then
electricity, I feel the same way as T cells. It's just like, I'm not sure anyone actually knows how this works.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that way about light, T cells, and electricity.
That's it, though.
Yeah, the rest of it.
Devoki knows everything else. It all makes perfect sense. We know everything there is to know about.
I'm an expert also on Bible interpretations. I picked the questions that cover my areas of expertise.
Right. I mean, ancient Hebrew wasn't that hard to figure out for Devoki.
Yes.
But photons, no.
Yeah.
Has anybody done it? Have they built at least a pilot plant?
People have tested it out. In 2007, apparently, a company tried out a system to do this.
That's probably the thing I wrote about in EcoGeek.
Mm.
That's probably the very story I cover.
The Alternative Energy Holdings, Inc.
Holdings is a good name because it's a business term for like a company that owns things. Mm. And then, but also it's actually literally trying to hold alternative energy.
Sounds like it's mostly theoretical.
Yeah, I think it seems almost like it's mostly like research rather than anything to do with practical.
There is a company that has tried to set off electric activity in thunderclouds with ultra-short lasers. So that's combining light and electricity. Great. So I believe it.
Now we are very confused. That's definitely... Look, you convinced me. Where do I sign up? I'm an investor now.
Yep.
Deboki, since you are the science person on the podcast and I probably know more about AFC Wimbledon than you, do you want to do the Mars news?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
Because this week in Mars news, it's very exciting. Researchers have found organic molecules on Mars that they hadn't found before. It's always fun to find some new molecules. And the researchers actually found out about this because like there was a drill on the Curiosity rover that was malfunctioning back in 2016. And so they were like, well, we can't drill for rock samples right now, which we really wanted to do. And we wanted to collect these for later experiments, but we still want to test some things out. And they had these cups with pre-mixed solvents in them. So they were like, we've got these sand samples from a beach. We're going to just dump some of that into this little cup of wet things and see what happens and see what we can learn from it. And so they were actually trying out a new technique for them, which is called wet sampling. And so there have been previous ways that we found organic molecules like toluene and benzene, and those are usually by heating the sediments up. So this mm-hmm. was the first time they were trying it out with this wet sampling technique. And from that, they found benzoic acid and some other organic molecules that were new to them. They also found ammonia, which is inorganic, but it's produced through the breakdown of other organic molecules. And so none of these tell us like how the molecules came around. They don't tell us like, you know, was there some kind of life that was making it? But it is cool that like we have this technique and that we can use this to find mm-hmm. these molecules, because these were things that were harder to find potentially with the other techniques that they'd been using.
Doing wet chemistry on Mars.
Yeah.
Just like the octopuses would.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe they've already done it. The dolphins have already been to Mars.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past them.
What if the dolphins had gotten to Mars and then that's why the water left and then they came back?
What did they do? Drink it?
I don't know.
So, in this week in AFC Wimbledon news, they're currently playing a couple tournaments that, as I think that I am correct about this, don't have an impact on standing. So they're in the Football League Trophy tournament, which I think that they probably are done with because they lost the first two games. But they're also in the FA Cup, and they won the first game of the FA Cup. That sounds like they won the FA Cup in the FA mm-hmm. Cup. That was against Gisli, which, because I've never heard of that team, I think it's in a lower league, so it's like pretty good. Like if they'd lost to that team, it probably would have been a really bad sign. They got a game coming up, so that's good. And the thing about the FA Cup, as far as I understand, is that the higher you go, the more you get paid. So if you can get a couple rounds into the FA Cup, then like you have a chance of playing a really big team, and then you make a bunch of money because they get like TV broadcast and stuff.
Right. That makes sense.
Very important. So AFC Wimbledon is not doing well. They're a couple of points out of the relegation zone. So if you're following along and listening in real time to the podcast, you will have heard the beginning of the season when things were looking great and we were very excited. And now we're in a situation where if we lose a couple more games, there's a good chance that we, I guess, mm-hmm. I'm an owner of the team, thanks to a gift from my brother, that we would be in the relegation zone. The good news is we've got two games coming up against teams that are not very good. Or aren't very high in the standings. I don't know how good teams are. Portsmouth and Crewe Alexandra. So both of those teams are lower in the standings along with AFC Wimbledon. So this is just not, it's not like we're playing like the best team in the league next week. So that's good. We're playing some lower down teams that we have a better chance against. And that's sort of what I look at when John's talking about AFC Wimbledon. I'm like, are we going to play a team that's like really good? And like, have we played a lot of the good teams and that's why we're lower down? I don't know. The bad news is that there are not a lot of goals being scored. Though appreciate moving out from the first round of the FA Cup. We don't know who we're playing for the second round. If we draw a really good team for that, then maybe it'll be a little extra fun. Maybe some people can see FC Wimbledon play on their televisions. And that's all I know.
Yeah.
Did I do a good job?
I think so.
I have no idea.
I follow the AFC Wimbledon updates, and then outside of the podcast, I live in an Arsenal household where, like, this is a team that started out the season. I mean, just like my one piece of life advice, because I'm showing up on this podcast, is like, if you have the option, like, somehow to tie your life to someone who is an Arsenal fan, don't do it. Like, I did it, and luckily he has enough.
I love this man a lot, but
it's introduced a lot of tragic moments in our household, and I still am now along for the ride. But you know, it is what it is. So sometimes I follow the AFC Wimbledon news feeling like, this sounds a lot like what being an Arsenal fan sounds like, where you're like, yes, I love them so much. And then also, no,
stop doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the AFC Wimbledon story is quite a story, but what we need is a billionaire to come along and give him a little leg up. Please, please, please. Devoki, thank you so much for being on this podcast with me today. It was a pleasure, and I learned a lot.
Thank you for having me. I also learned a lot about where my head will go with science if I am given too much space.
If you want to ask your questions to us, our email address is hankandjohn@gmail.com. And without those questions, we don't have a podcast. So thank you so much to everybody for sending them in, whether they are about science or not. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tuna Medish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant, hey, it's Devoki Chakravarti.
Me.
The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.